This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing clinical psychologist Mark Dadds, director of the Child Behaviour Research Clinic at the University of Sydney. Mark recently won the ACAM Eric Taylor Translational Research into Practice Award. He is particularly interested in the development of health versus psychopathology, especially common problems like aggression, antisocial behaviour, anxiety and depression. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with the rating or review and do share with friends and colleagues. Mark, welcome. Thank you for joining me and congratulations on your ACAM award. Can you start with a brief introduction of who you are and what you do?
I'm a clinical psychologist living in Sydney, Australia, and working at the University of Sydney, where I'm very lucky to be a principal research fellow for the National Health and Medical Research Council of Australia and director of the Child Behaviour Research Clinic, which is an inner city Sydney clinic that treats children from 2 to 8 with all sorts of developmental and behavioural problems, and increasingly treating kids from all over Australia and all over the world because, we've largely gone online now with our treatment, both due to a need to do that just to get greater access and reach to our treatment, but also because of the pandemic, of course.
And Mark, how did you come to be interested in child and adolescent mental health?
I feel like I just drifted into it, to be quite honest. I was studying physics and so on at University of Melbourne, and I found it incredibly dry. And I can remember that my girlfriend at the time was studying psychology, and I found myself increasingly drifting over to her lectures, loving the history of psychology and the history of medicine in general. First, I changed to history of public health and germ theory and studied kind of epidemiology and general approaches to human health. I became increasingly interested in mental health and then ran away from Melbourne with a band I was playing in, ended up in Queensland. Thought, while I'm here playing in this band, I better keep studying. So I enrolled in psychology and then gradually drifted into clinical psychology, and was lucky enough to work with Matt Sanders. People will probably know Matt Sanders as the founder of the Triple P program. And he became my supervisor when I was a PhD student. And yeah, that was it.
Mark, you won the ACAM Eric Taylor Translational Research into Practice Award, which I understand you collected live at 4 a.m. from Sydney at the ceremony broadcast from London. You've made an extraordinary contribution to the science of child mental health through original, innovative research translated into interventional programs that are implemented worldwide. Translating research into practice is often an area that researchers struggle with. How have you managed to be so successful at this?
Well, I think in a way I've just been very lucky. I've been able to always keep one foot in the clinical camp and one foot in the research camp. And by having a research fellowship with the NHMRC in Australia, I'm incredibly lucky that my time is free to be a full-time clinical researcher. Secondly, I was raised in an environment where of the scientist practitioner, where the science was really not much point unless you were really invested in some real world problem. And my supervisor used to always say to me, you can tell this person's articles that they've never actually seen a child, even though it's reasonable research, you can just tell. I always have kept treating families and children all the way through my career, and so I've always had an eye on the actual clinical practice. The research has, always been informed by that. And I suppose a third influence on me, which was very interesting, was back in the 70s when I studied, certain people at University of Melbourne looked at China as a revolution, as a role model. when we probably didn't know about some of the horrors that occurred then. But the idea of the barefoot doctors was a model that I was raised into, which is that the researchers have to go back into the fields. And if you're a doctor, you should be a barefoot doctor. You have to go back to the village and live there and understand the problems of the village in order to be a true researcher and an expert and so on.
And that translation into practice, why is it so important in particular when it comes to child and adolescent mental health?
Oh, look, that's a fabulous question. When I started back in the 80s and so on in Australia, and it would have been the same in the UK, if you had a child who had early onset mental health problems or behavioural and emotional issues, and you took them to a clinic, what was most likely to happen was that you would have been left outside and the child would have been taken in and some sort of play therapy would have occurred. And the therapist would have been trying to get the child to express their deeper inner conflicts and so on. And also as a parent, you probably would have been seen as to blame for the problem. There's almost no evidence that this approach worked. And in fact, in my experience, it can make things a lot better because the parents become disenfranchised from the process. The child is just being reinforced for expressing problems and so on like that. Mm-hmm. And so we've seen a massive shift in just a few decades towards evidence-based practice. And with kids, these interventions actually can do really, really positive good and they can do positive harm. In my experience, much more than with adults. And so it's incredibly important that we do things that actually help rather than just what we think helps.
Mark, I want to focus on some of the intervention programs that you've developed, and many of these are world firsts. One is a theory-driven intervention for children with callous, unemotional traits. What can you tell us about that program?
This is a really challenging one. The most common treatment that certainly I do, and it's done all over the world, involves training parents in positive parenting strategies for children with aggressive antisocial behaviour. And this is one of the great achievements of the behavioural sciences. While it doesn't work in every case, it works in most cases, and these children show wonderful improvements. Most of the kids with that sort of behaviour problem tend to be quite emotional and dysregulated. But there are some kids that are the opposite. They're quite unemotional, callous, and they're lacking in empathy and so on. These kids don't do so well. They're less susceptible, if you like, to the quality of parenting that they're receiving. So we've been trying to work on a treatment for that. Really, the essence of this treatment is that these children are somewhat insensitive to other people's emotion. And so we believe that that makes them very difficult to parent. And one of the ways that they are less sensitive is that they don't engage with other people's emotions, look into their eyes, resonate with how they feel and so on. So what we've been doing is trying to keep the solid foundation of these positive parent training programs, but add in elements very carefully that address these kids' lack of empathy and so on. We've shown that these kids definitely show this kind of lack of engagement with other people's emotions, but our ability to shift it is proving quite difficult, I have to say. We've been able to get really short, powerful changes in these kids' interest in other people's emotions, but we're finding that it goes back to where one after treatment. But we do still get behaviour change in their antisocial behaviour, but it's just harder getting change in the callous traits in these children. At conferences where I've spoken about this, I've had some people say, Mark, what does it matter if they're not being antisocial anymore? Who cares if they're callous? And I'm like, nice point. But on the other hand, it's kind of like, well, if they're still callous, but they're not showing any social behaviour, maybe just they're being more successful in their callousness. So it's a very interesting issue, this, and it's a story that isn't finished yet.
In 2019, you co-authored a paper published in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, the JCPP, evaluating that programme. Can you say anything more about the actual findings of the research?
In terms of the effects of the positive parenting on the children's behaviour, we got really wonderful effects. The majority of these kids showed significant improvements in their antisocial conduct problem behavior. The parents were very happy with the kids' behavior and so on. But we didn't get any bang for our buck by adding in the component where we focused on what we call this kind of love engagement, where they look into each other's eyes. We train the kids how to recognize emotions in other people, how to care about those emotions and all that. We found that adding that didn't really add much benefit over and above just getting the mum and the dad to spend quality time with the child each day. It's possible that that's what the story is, that if you do the positive parenting program, but you also spend lots of quality time, you know, trying to engage and express love, reciprocated love with these kids, it's enough to change their antisocial behavior. But as I said, the depressing part was, even though we got big shifts in their callousness, at the end of treatment, they were still in the high level range on callous unemotional traits.
Mark, let's turn to some of your other interventions. You have programs which are school-based early interventions and also family-based programs to tackle child anxiety. Can you tell us some more about these interventions?
Well, these are, again, are another wonderful success of the clinical psychology and psychiatry. When I started, behavioral programs focused on anxious kids, which were pretty much about just exposing the child, kind of get back on the horse approach, if you like. I knew that that approach was the best way to go, but there were really no packaged, disseminatable programs that were readily available for these kids. Philip Kendall in the USA, in Philadelphia, developed a program called the Hope in CAT, which was really one of these programs that packaged this cognitive behavioral approach with children into a manualized treatment. We took that in Australia and turned that into what we called the coping koala at that point. And it was an approach that really leveraged the parents and trained the parents in how to work with their kids in that regard and so on. And that became a very successful treatment. In the late 1990s, I thought we need to have this as a school-based preventative strategy. We went into the schools and we screened the schools in a way that was hopefully not at all stigmatizing for the children. We identified the kids that were at risk for anxiety problems, and we ran a fun kind of after-school program. And it was really lovely. We got effects up until 2 years where the rates of anxiety disorders were lower in those kids than those that hadn't received it.
Mark, a major focus of your work is understanding interparental processes whereby parental systems work together to maximise child outcomes. Can you tell me more about this aspect of your work?
This was really the first thing that I did when I first started working with Matt Sanders in Queensland. My focus was on how the parents work together or don't work together when you do these positive parent training programs. I was struck clinically by just how many parents were suffering from really quite problematic levels of conflict with their spouses. And when it came to parenting, it was very common for one parent to identify as a tough one as the softy. And every time there'd be a child behavior problem, it would really escalate into the marital relationship, if you like. And so you've got this conflict spreading throughout the family. And what I discovered was that when parents are not working as a team, these parenting programs don't work very well. And so it's really, really critical that parents are engaged together and work as a team. Now, when I started, it was basically just mums coming in to get these positive parent training programs. We knew very little about the dad. And very often she was going home to an environment in which the changes she were trying to make were just being ignored, or the dad was hostile to them. And we found that you don't really need to go into, you know, kind of deep intensive marital therapy with all of these families. If you just call a moratorium on the marital problems, invite them to work as a team, put their own thing aside, get the child's behavior under control. For a lot of these families, they go, oh my goodness, that's the first time we've achieved something together in ages. And then we try and get them back dating again. And, you know, and it's actually can be a way of repairing problematic or exhausted marital relationships through these positive parenting programs.
You mentioned dads. I want to go back to dads. And you talked about how originally it was nearly always the mums that would turn up. What's the situation now? How involved are fathers? And why is their involvement so important when it comes to child mental health?
So this is a wonderful question. As I said, you know, back in the day, it was really just mums. And the evidence was in the positive parenting training programs all around the world that fathers were really not getting involved. And if you look at something in Australia, we have a thing called the Raising Children's Network online, which is a resource online. And it has tens and tens of thousands of people go to that website every day seeking help. And still the vast majority of those are women. But men are slowly increasing their interest and their engagement at this level. Now, in 2008-ish, I think it might have been, I went to Movember Foundation and said, you know, do you realise that most problems of aggression are in young boys? The ones that are seeking help for this are the mums, and the people they are seeing to get help are mostly young women psychologists. Mm. And so you've got a problem of male aggression being almost solely addressed by women in our society, and it's time that the men stepped up. Movember resonated with this and funded us for the Like Father, Like Son project, which we devoted to collecting data on fathers' engagement, speaking with fathers, developing programs for them, and so on. When fathers participate in these positive parent training programs, you get a jump up in their effectiveness. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't work for single parents and so on, or a parent that does it on their own.
In terms of father participation, how have you increased participation? How have you made them accessible?
We first spoke to practitioners and fathers about what they wanted and what would have it work. And it was pretty simple. The father said, number one, we want to be involved. Number two, we want to know that this stuff works. We don't want it to be just, you know, nonsense. We want it to be straight to the point and brief. And we want to feel welcome. We want to feel that it speaks our language, you know, because for a lot of men, they felt like if they were coming to these programs, they were really entering some kind of foreign nation of women that they didn't feel comfortable in. And it was very interesting, I should say, that when we spoke to a lot of the young practitioners, all we'd say to them was, fathers, what do you think about fathers? And do you know what the first thing that would come into their mind was? Abuse, alcohol, family violence. And we'd be like, oh my goodness me. So we decided to try and make resources that were father-friendly, spoke their language, were effective, could be accessed online and so on. We trained practitioners in how to speak, kind of dad speak, if you like. And we've shown that this is leading to a big improvement in father engagement in these programs. And so when we did the parent work study, which was designed to be father-friendly, we got 50% fathers, 50% mothers engaged in that. Now, just back to your question, how do we get them involved? It was really through media campaigns. We went into all of the traditional media, went through social media and spread the word.
It also sounds as if there had to be work around changing attitudes of practitioners. You said as soon as you mentioned the word dad, they would think of abuse and alcohol and so on. So fathers were kind of judged before they even participated.
Yeah, I found this really, really interesting. And we set up a practitioner training program because we had already developed a model for how to engage all parents that were feeling like they didn't want to be there. We had a nice little system for how to listen to them, how to make them feel welcome and so on. So we implemented that and we turned it into an online training program for practitioners. It only took 2 hours and it was simply how to speak to fathers and so on. And we got really lovely results from that in terms of improvements in practitioner confidence, willingness to work with fathers. Now, it's interesting, though, this also involves systems change, because traditionally the mental health systems were set up to run from 9 to 5 when most work and couldn't really get away. You had young female practitioners working 9 to 5. They felt a little bit uncomfortable with some of the fathers. It was probably in a way easier for them to just work those hours and have mums coming in during the day, if you like. And so we had the whole system geared up to making it very difficult for fathers to access these treatments. Not only have we trained the practitioners, but we've tried to say, you need to gear up your whole system so that it has flexible hours or flexible access through online engagement and so on. Be ready to talk to fathers and welcome them in and let them know this is an evidence-based treatment and that they are part of the solution.
Mark, you've also developed a range of assessment devices used globally for routine clinical and research practice, such as the Griffith Empathy Measure. Can you tell us about these devices?
I should probably say that while we developed them, many of them escaped, if you like, into the world rather than were deliberately released. And it's an interesting story, and I'm sure a lot of other people have had this experience. We develop a little measure that we needed for one particular purpose. So, for example, the GEM, the Griffith Empathy Measure, we needed to be able to measure empathy in our kids. And so we developed a little measure. And before we got it right, this thing kind of was out and had been escaped into the world, and people were using it all over the world. And I think that the GEM now has been translated into about a dozen languages. But recently I was criticized by someone that this measure doesn't do all it was, we would hope it would do, which I actually agree with. It's true. So these things are not bad little measures, but of course they could always be better. But the ones we've done are the Griffith Empathy Measure, which was quite new in measuring in empathy in that way. We've done a few in measuring marital conflict, you know, what we spoke about before. Can parents work as a partnership when bringing up their children? So that one was called the Parent Problem Checklist, which is used quite extensively now.
Mark, you're interested in research and clinical work that tries to map human interpersonal processes, such as love and empathy, cooperation and coercion, onto the genetics and neural function of the systems that underpin our behaviours in order to build more effective treatments for children. What is the latest in this area and your involvement in it?
I got really, really interested in the biological side of things, especially genetics and epigenetics about 15 years ago, when there was a big hope in those days that understanding the genome was going to make a significant contribution to our understanding of complex human processes. I would say at this point that it hasn't done that, that the structure of the genome has contributed very little understanding of anything so far, except for us to know that the way we are and when we are healthy and unhealthy is very unlikely to be able to be found in terms of just the typical genetics of our DNA. However, the epigenetic processes, if you like, in terms of how the DNA is converted into us, how it's converted into proteins, and then how those proteins form into complex chemical processes that inform health versus paraphysiology, is becoming, I think, a very exciting process. And so if you take the example of epigenetic processes, we know now that the way the genome is converted into our function has quite strong and reliable implications for the kind of people we are. We have shown that the way that certain genes are turned up in volume or turned down in volume through a process called methylation affects the way the child expresses behavioral and emotional problems. And so if you take a gene like the oxytocin gene, transcribes receptors for oxytocin, which is involved in everything from childbirth to looking at other people's eyes, empathy, pair bonding, and so on. That gene can be turned up or down by methylation processes. And kids that are low on empathy and concern for other people tend to have that receptor gene turned down in volume. These discoveries, I think, are very, very important. The question is, what's the psychological processes that are impacting on the dampening or the upregulating of these particular genes? I think this is just a wonderful new field where we need the psychologist to be speaking to the pathophysiologists, the geneticists, and so on about integrating those two models. How can we make sense of critical things in our life like love, tenderness, violence, and so on? And how do they turn particular gene expression up versus turn it down in the developing child?
Do you see it as reversible, though?
Oh, I think the evidence is that it is reversible, yes. I think there will be processes that turn the gene expressions back up again. What they are and how we can do that, we're only at the beginning of answering. The one we've been playing with, in fact, this was the one that was in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry paper you referred to before. That process with the callous children that we've been experimenting with is really about love and reciprocated eye gaze. Mm-hmm. I think this is one of the critical human processes that begins at birth. And I think that it's a very powerful expression of the deepest parts of who we are. And I think that it's involved with hormones like oxytocin. And I think that engaging in that kind of close reciprocated love eye gaze actually teaches the child to imitate, to pay attention, and so on, and probably upregulates some of the genes necessary for doing that.
How far away do you think we are then from having a much greater grasp on it?
I think it's still going to take a decade or so. The trouble with this work is that it just takes really large, quite expensive studies. You know, I've been so lucky to be able to have been supported to do some of this research, but it's outside of the realm of most people because you've got to not only be working with kids in clinics and have access to them, but you've got to be able to have an understanding of the genetics. You've got to have the ability to collect human samples and so on. This is just complicated research that involves cutting across multiple disciplines and so on.
What else are you working on currently?
To be quite honest, my great love at the moment is making fine furniture, but that's probably not the place to talk about this. Oh, the other one is playing in my little jazz band. That's what I'm working on. I love those. But if we stay with psychology at the moment, I feel very lucky to have three studies about to come out. The first one is that we're checking whether our positive parenting training program does change the child's genetics. So that's going to be very exciting. We'll be finishing that this year. We've also been following a large group of children through for 3 years from birth to have a look at how they develop attention to other people's emotions and so on. Finally, we're funded at the moment to be evaluating a treatment for autism, childhood autism, that brings together what we think are three critical ingredients in these children's development, brings them together into one package for the first time. So we're evaluating what the effects of that on development of autism in kids.
Can you say what the three things are?
Now, none of these are particularly original, but it's the first time they've been put together in one package. And I'm interested in whether these things work synergistically, if you like, if they enhance the effects of each other. So when we work with the kids, the first thing you need to do with a child that's struggling and has autism is help them get rid of any aggressive, aberrant type behaviours they have, repetitive behaviours, hurting themselves, hitting other people, these sorts of things, reduce that and increase the rate at which they have positive engagement and self-regulation and so on. So the first one is like a behavioral program. People will know that as like an ABA approach. Second element is use these parent-child social communication interventions, which have been developed pretty much very nicely by UK groups. Jonathan Green have been doing wonderful work with developing these social communicative interventions. So once you've got the child's behaviour improving a little bit, train up the parents in spending time with the child and working on their engagement, their reciprocation and so on. So our third element is to do our interparental support program, our marital teamwork type things. And this comes back, you'll hear, with my general interests, but a lot of these parents are really struggling. You know, it's really hard to raise children with developmental problems like this. Very few people ever talk to them about how they're coping. Now, our hypothesis is if you do them in that order, the ABA, the social communicative, the more general parent mental health, that we're hoping that we can see some sustained changes in these kids and their family.
Mark, is there anything else in the pipeline that you'd like to mention?
The other one is that we've applied for a large grant in Australia to introduce a national system for child mental health called Growing Minds Australia. This is my dream, really. It's probably my swan song. And that is that we have a system where it's like a cooperative empowerment mental health for the whole country. And when you have kids, you sign your family up to be an empowered member of the club. And this gives you access to online mental health checkups and the best possible evidence-based support in terms of this is what might help at this point for this problem, etc., where we have a clearinghouse for all of the best online treatments. And so rather than it just being this piecemeal relying on parents identifying problems and knowing where to go, we finally have a unified mental health system.
Brilliant. And finally, Mark, what is your take-home message for those listening to our conversation?
In this world where nonsense can float to the top and have so much impact on people's lives, I would just like to say we need science more than ever. We need evidence-based approaches more than ever, but we also need evidence-based approaches that speak to everyday problems, the barefoot doctor approach, if you like, the research that gets back out into the field and addresses problems that are common and need addressing.
Mark, thank you so much. For more details on Mark Dads, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.
Let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.